Inelastic economy. For the multiplier to operate, it is necessary that the economy is characterized by rising supply curve. It is only then that the output expands at several rounds, as is assumed in the multiplier theory. This is possible for industrial economies that the advanced countries are, but not for agricultural economies which the backward countries are. Industrial countries are much less dependent upon nature as compared to agricultural countries. Even agriculture in advanced countries has been industrialized with an increasing proportion of non-farm inputs like chemical fertilizers, research seeds, machines, pesticides, etc. As a result, the output expansion is marked by a flexible curve that moves up smoothly given increases in the demand for goods. It is not so in the case of non-industrial countries. Nature is very much dominant, with traditional inputs like green manure, farm seeds, rainwater, etc. predominant. The industrial sector too is beset with handicaps of transport, power, managerial ability, finance, etc. In brief, these economies are not characterized by elastic supply curves that are waiting to move up as the demand signals. Now the last point is inflationary price rise. Since the underlying assumptions of the multiplier are not valid fully or even largely, the multiplier effect in an underdeveloped country like India is very limited. Any attempt at raising the monetary demand of the people adds little to the output. Instead, such a course leads to rise in prices of the goods. With consumer goods in short supply or rising at a very slow pace, bouts of increase in money demand result in inflationary spiral. This, in fact, has been the Indian experience. For large many years in the past, as also at the present, large increases in money supply have operated as one very important factor in raising the general level of prices. This proves the point that the growth of output or national income in India has to be viewed not from the demand angle, as the Keynesian economics does, but from the supply angle. The problem of slow growth has therefore to be diagnosed in terms of what hinders the production. The conclusion thus is obvious. Keynesian multiplier as a key to growth has a very limited validity in the Indian conditions. National income by industrial origin. Having taken up the growth of national income, we now discuss the contributions or shares of different producing sectors of the economy of the national income. Such a study gives us a picture of the composition or structure of the total product of the economy. Changes in this picture over time depicts the changes in the standing of the product producing sectors in the economy. All this enables one to know whether the economy is moving forward or backward. The significant changes. The different producing sectors' contribution to the domestic product have been grouped under the following three heads. One is agriculture and allied activities. This includes agriculture, forestry and logging and fishing. Second is industry. It is comprised of mining and quarrying, manufacturing, electricity, gas and water supply. Third is services. It is composed of the following subsectors: trade, hotels and restaurants, transport, storage, communication, financing, insurance and real estate, community, social and personal services and construction. So the three groups are agriculture, industry and services. Now we look at the developmental character. The sectoral composition of the domestic product has, as a result of the growth of the economy in the past, changed a lot. It no longer resembles the one which characterized it in the years following independence of the country in 1947. The changes in it in fact amount to a transformation of the production structure of a backward economy to that of a developing economy. This is obvious from the changes in the standing of the three sectors in the domestic product, in particular that of agriculture and services. There is a big decline in the share of agriculture. More importantly, there is a big jump up in the share of services. The share of industry too has changed, with some increase in it, although it is much less compared to that of the services. In fact, the share of services in the domestic product is at present more than the shares of the two commodity sectors, agriculture and industry put together. When these changes are viewed together, one is inclined to conclude that the economy is no longer an agricultural economy, at least to the extent it was at the beginning of the period. The high standing of the services also point to the fact that the growth of the economy is in the developed countries seems to be fueled more by this sector than by other sectors. The change in the status of industry is also important in so far as there is a continuous increase in its share of the domestic product, pinpointing a movement towards making Indian economy an industrial economy. These changes are of considerable significance for the future growth of the economy. 1. A strong basis for growth of the economy has been laid down. Agriculture, which has not been a force for propelling the sustaining growth anywhere in the world, has declined, with its share in the domestic product going down considerably. On the other hand, the non-agricultural sectors, in particular the service sector, have, as in developed countries, become the forces of growth. 2. The growth of economy will no longer be as much subject to the ups and downs of agriculture, which continues to be heavily dependent upon uncertain rains. This will impart some stability to the growth of the economy. All in all, the economy has undergone a pro-growth transformation. Slow and small change. While the fact of significant pro-growth change in the sectoral composition of domestic product is there, it has however been slow in coming and small in effect. It has, for example, taken as many as 50 years for this change to happen. And despite long many years, the effect has been a small one when one compares it with the developed countries. In those countries, agriculture contributes to the domestic product only about 2%, industry 33% and services 65%. Seen in this context, Indian economy is far away from the stage reached by the developed high-income countries. Another facet of the Indian economy also reinforces the same conclusion. India's occupational structure, that is distribution of workforce as among the three producing sectors, with 67% of the workforce in agriculture, is similar to the present-day advanced countries when they were backward. In the USA, as far back as in 1870, agriculture absorbed 50% of its workforce. In Japan, in 1877, about 83% of the labor force was engaged in agriculture. At present, the proportion of workforce in agriculture in most of the developed countries is much less, at around 3-7%. Differing performance. The changes in the shares of the three sectors are a result of the differences in the progress made by them. Overall, the performance has not been satisfactory, particularly in the commodity sectors, namely agriculture and allied activities and industry. Improvements in their outputs will raise the growth rate of the economy and further change the sectoral composition of the domestic products. Agriculture and allied activities. A low growth rate in this sector has pulled down its standing in the domestic product. However, it needs to be stressed that a low growth rate of this sector is not desirable. On the contrary, an increase in its growth rate is very much needed to raise the growth rate of the economy. It is its share in the domestic product that will continue to decline vis-a-vis the other two sectors as the economy develops. As for its growth, this sector has large potential in several crops and in several regions. There is again much that can be achieved through an improvement in the yield of land. Besides farming, there is a great scope in raising the output from activities allied to agriculture. What is needed is a multi-pronged strategy to remove obstacles in the output growth of this sector and provide adequate incentives and inputs for boosting production and productivity. The various directions in which measures are required to be undertaken to increase output are, for example, land reforms, investment, in particular public investment in irrigation, research in biotechnology, etc., easy movement of agricultural products or free trade inside and outside the country, etc. An appropriate set of measures are also needed to create a suitable environment and adequate incentives favorable for a rapid growth of this sector. Industry. The growth rate of industrial production, though fair, has not been large enough to raise its share in the domestic product significantly. It is because of several reasons. The investment in this sector, in particular in the infrastructure related to industry, has been very low indeed. Again, for large many years, till the 90s of the 20th century, the strategy of development has been focused on the heavy and capital goods industries. As these industries have a high capital output ratio and are long gestating, the output flows have been small and slow in coming. These are unlike the consumer goods industries, being emphasized in the present, that have a low capital output ratio and are short gestating, therefore cause more output to flow and over a short period. Another reason for the unsatisfactory performance of the industrial sector has been the restrictive environment, that is licenses, quotas, regulation, etc., which for long many years stifled efficiency, innovations, private investment and entrepreneurship, etc. The remedial measures comprise of a package which include the following: demolition of all restrictive measures or liberalization to permit functioning of markets in products and factors of production to achieve allocative efficiency, extension of competition among the producing units and the trading units to secure cost or price efficiency, increase in investment, including foreign direct investment, to induct latest technologies and management practices, etc., to accelerate the pace of capital formation, including infrastructure, upgrading of financial institutions relating to industrial finance, suitable macroeconomic policies to stabilize prices, exchange rates, interest rates, etc. Services. The growth rate has been significant enough to raise its share in the domestic product to more than that of the commodity sectors put together. An important aspect of this change is that, when compared to the present developed countries, it has taken place in a relatively short period of time. As such, India's experience in this respect is an altogether different one. It marks a big jump over or leapfrogging for the economy from a lower stage to a higher stage, the former associated with the agriculture sector, making lower order of value additions to the national income, and the latter with the service sector contributing higher level of value additions. The stage in between that India seems to have skipped and which the developed countries have traversed is one where technological improvements take place to further the process of steady growth of an economy. India has made use of the already developed technologies, an advantage that curiously enough has occurred to her for being late starter in development. The much larger share of the service sector in the domestic product will have several implications, mostly beneficial for the economy. One, given an appropriate policy conducive to greater competition and efficiency, which the economic reforms aim at, the service sector can be expected to contribute a lot more in raising and sustaining a higher growth rate for the economy, as also for exports in such items as softwares. Two, this development also opens up the doors for the employment of people who will shift from agriculture and industry as a consequence of rise in productivity in these commodity sectors on account of technological progress. 3. Another consequence of this change in the sectoral composition of domestic product will be reflected in the consumption basket of the people. An increasing proportion of people's expenditure will shift from commodities to services. 4. Still another important implications relate to government budgets. The expanding service sector indicates a big potential for increasing tax revenue by offering a vast scope for extending the tax base. To conclude, the changes in the sectoral composition of gross domestic product, that is GDP, despite some unsatisfactory features, are development oriented, and hold out a great promise for the future. With this, we have come to the end of chapter number 13, that is National Income, Measurement, Growth and Industrial Origin. Now, we will continue with chapter number 14, Income Distribution and Poverty. Name of the book Indian Economy, written by A.N. Agarwal. Page numbers from 197 to 207. Income Distribution and Poverty. An important aspect of the study of national income is its distribution. In this chapter, we shall discuss the subject of equality or inequality in the distribution of income. Another key issue partly connected with the distribution is the dire poverty of the large masses of people. This will be analyzed along with an explanation of the Indian paradox of growth with massive poverty and an evaluation of the various policies and programs aimed at the eradication of this evil. Inequalities in distribution. Indian economy is beset with gross economic inequalities. There are inequalities in incomes, with a very few cornering a very large chunk of total income and a very large number getting a very small proportion. Lying behind and also partly responsible for these inequalities is the ownership of assets like land, heavily tilted in favor of the very small number of the wealthy people. These inequalities are more severe in respect of the consumption levels of the few at the top and the many at the bottom. Extent of inequalities. To understand the distribution picture, we should first have an idea of the extent of inequalities. This will be helpful in grasping the seriousness of the problem, as also in looking for the causes and for devising measures for reducing these inequalities to a desirable level. Various facets. The distribution of income in the economy is highly inequitable. At the one end, there are a very few at the top, constituting a very small percentage of the total population, who command a very large proportion of the national income. At the bottom are a very large number, constituting a substantial percentage of population, but with a very small share in the national income. These inequalities have existed for long. These inequalities also mark the rural and the urban areas, with larger inequalities in the latter. The income inequalities are also reflected in the inequitable sharing of consumption. In fact, with the exclusion of investment expenditure, the consumption aspect becomes a better index of the distance between the haves and the have-nots. From this angle, the situation is no better. In fact, it is worse. Even when one takes note of public consumption, that is, might be education or health services for the poor, it is inequitable. These inequalities among classes or persons, when viewed in terms of states, exhibit some more unsatisfactory features, with some better off states as against some worse off states. Large magnitude. The fact of gross inequalities is very much evident from the several estimates and inquiries made from time to time. No doubt the information in this respect is not adequate and very little is available in a time series. Nevertheless, estimates made from time to time, when viewed in a chronological order, leave no doubt about the existence of large inequalities, as also no or very little reduction in them over time. At present, that was in the year of 1997, 20% of the individuals or households at the lowest or bottom rung of the income ladder, also described as the lowest fifth or the first quintile, receive only 8.1% of the national income. At the other end, 20% individuals or households at the highest rung of the income ladder, also described as the highest fifth or the fifth quintile, take away as much as 46.1% of the national income. If one takes up the lowest 10% individuals or households at one end and the highest 10% at the other end, the fact of inequality is more glaring, with the lowest getting as little as 3.5% of the national income and the highest getting as much as 33.5% of national income. Such an unsatisfactory distribution profile has been marked in the past too. This is evident from the estimates of the World Bank. For example, in 1975-76, the lowest 20% of the households got just 7% of the national income and the highest 20% received 49.4% of the national income. In 1989-90, there was a slight improvement in the share of the lowest 20%, which was 8.8%, and some decline in the share of the highest 20%, which became 41.3%. The position in 1992 was no better, in fact worse, with the share of the lowest 20% at 8.5% and that of the highest 20% at 42.6%. These facts of large inequality in income distribution existed even before. According to an estimate by Lydall, that is, he estimated that in the year of 1955 and 56, the top 10% appropriated as much as 34% of the national income, but the bottom as many as 25% could get just 9.6%. Another later estimate, that is from 1956 and 57, made by Iyengar and Mukherjee, points to the same story. 10% of households in the highest group received 25% of the national income, but the 25% in the lowest group had to live with as little as 8.5% of the national income. Unsatisfactory state. The degree of inequalities as described above matches somewhat that of some of the developed countries. This income distribution may even be less unequal compared to that of some developing countries. This sounds good, but this is no cause of satisfaction. When viewed in the context of Indian conditions, these inequalities present a very dismal picture. 1. The size of the cake, that is national income. Size of national income being small, the amount going to the bottom 20% is bound to be meager because of the small share of this class, and this amount has remained small over the long past because the growth rate of national income has been a slow one. 2. The size of population being very large and the growth in it being rapid, the absolute number of people falling in the bottom group has indeed been huge. As a result, the per capita income of these people is very small. No wonder large many Indians are very poor. 3. These inequalities being large and persistent have been an important cause of tensions among the haves and the have-nots. These tensions sometimes take on political colors because people in the bottom rung belong to socially deprived classes like scheduled castes, scheduled tribes, and other backward classes. Now we'll look at causes of income inequalities. Having known that there exist large inequalities, it is necessary to analyze their causes. There are various factors responsible for this phenomena. The first one is growth sector. Strangely enough, one reason is the growth itself. As development proceeds, the earnings of different groups raise differently. The income of the upper income and middle income group rise more rapidly than those of the poor. This happens in the early stages of growth through which India is passing at present. This phenomena, first hinted at by Simon Kuznets, has also been observed in many other developing countries. The explanation lies in the shift of population from agriculture, which is slow-growing sector, to the modern, largely industrial sector, which grows more rapidly. This tendency is accentuated by many other factors also. One such factor is the rapidly rising rural population, which keeps the earnings depressed in the villages. As against this, those who enter the modern sector get larger share of the rising income. Further, those with skills get still larger incomes as the demand for the skilled labor rises much faster than that of the unskilled labor. Again, there is the capital-intensive nature of the development of the modern sector. Since this absorbs less labor, wages from a smaller proportion of total income. Hence, the income spread is not wide enough. On the other hand, the capital-intensive type of growth leads to concentration of income in those few hands who supply capital. Another factor accentuating inequalities is urbanization. Since modern industries are generally located in urban areas, they give rise to the demands of urban population for such things as transport, housing, drainage, water supply, electricity, health services, etc. To meet these demands, government undertakes large expenditure. This also accentuates income inequalities in as much as urbanites are better placed as compared to the rural people in taking advantage of these jobs or income earning opportunities. In brief, people already better placed, that is upper income and middle income groups. People who are already better placed are quick to move to new growth centers, acquire skill for the same, supply capital and seize opportunities of urban development. The poor do not get much. In fact, they may even be worse off. Now, the second cause for inequality is highly unequal asset distribution. Incomes are derived from two main sources, namely assets like land, cattle, shares, etc., and labor. In India, a few own a large chunk of income-earning assets. Some others who do not own or own a part of the assets they operate, organize finances through banks, cooperatives, etc., and acquire or hire productive assets. For example, in the villages, some have large operational holdings which consist of owned land or leased land from others. As against these, few and overwhelming majority has little assets for earning. These inequalities enable the few to get incomes in the form of rent, interest and profit. As these assets accumulate and pass on from generation to generation, the earning capacity of these continuously increases. Nothing of the sort happens with the vast masses. Such inequalities are to be found both in the urban and the rural areas. Similar is the case with regions. The spread of asset formation in different regions have been uneven. For example, development of infrastructure as also location of industries have been much more in certain regions, particularly in the already advanced regions, than in others. The data in respect of the owner distribution are enough to prove this source of unequal incomes. As for the rural areas, the ownership pattern of the most important assets, namely land, is highly unequal. According to the source, the marginal households with holdings less than 1.01 hectares, which accounts for as many as 72% of the rural households, own very little, about 17% of the land. At the other end, there are those with large holdings of more than 10 hectares who are about 1% of the rural households, but they have under their ownership as much as 14% of the area. The position in cities is no different. Some time back, the National Council of Applied Economic Research estimated that 57% of the built-up property is in the possession of the top 10% property owners, whereas the bottom 10% of such households own only 1% of this property. In case of ownership pattern of shares, the inequalities are all the more glaring. Long back, Mahalanobis Boys estimated that more than half of the assets in the form of shares is concentrated in the hands of 1/10 of the top 1% of the households receiving profit income. At present, the picture is unlikely to be different. With large-scale tax evasion and large flow of black money, there are indications that there might have been worsening of the situation.
The next cause of income inequalities is inadequate employment generation. People at the bottom could raise their economic status and to an extent reduce the distance separating them from those at the top if they could get work. In other words, if they did not possess adequate earning assets, they could at least earn from their labor. But there too, the situation have not been favorable. For long, the increase in employment opportunities remain less than the rise in the labor force. The sixth plan itself laments when it says that the pace of generation of employment opportunities seems to have lagged behind the growth of the labor force, and that the number of people unemployed and underemployed has risen significantly over the last decade. The situation at present continues to be bad, since many remain unemployed or underemployed. Their earnings continue to be little or nil for most of their lives. The result is that these people remain at the lowest rung of the income scale, and the number of such people increases with the rapid growth of population. While this happens with these workless and assetless people, there are a few at the upper end of the scale who continue to add to their incomes and income earning assets. All this explains the fact of large inequalities of incomes. The next cause of income inequalities is differential regional growth. Of the large many at the bottom rung of incomes, a very great proportion lives in the poor or backward states or regions, and most of the few at the top live in the high income states or regions. This is the geographical facet of income inequalities for the country as a whole. Within the state, of course, there are inequalities perhaps large in the poorer states. Both these aspects are the outcome of the different growth rates of the states, with a few having grown at the fast rate and many having lagged behind. Those growing rapidly have performed well in the agriculture and in industries, or in both. The slow growing states have little to show in either, with growth rates much lower than the growth rate of the country as a whole. Some states have lagged far behind other faster growing states, which have experienced a much higher growth rate than the all India average. As a result, some states continue to be inhabited by many poor with their per capita incomes much below the national average. The next subheading is desirable and undesirable inequalities. While inequalities need to be reduced, it should be noted that all inequalities should not be reduced or eliminated. All inequalities are not undesirable. In fact, some are desirable. The first is distinction. As such, one should draw a line between justified and unjustified inequalities. In making such a distinction, the following things need to be mentioned. 1. In our economy, where private ownership of resources predominates, the personal income for some are constituted by property income, that is, interest, rent, profit, besides labor income. This may be justified, but from the welfare angle, even in this regard, there has to be limits. This implies that there should be transfer of some of the assets to the less fortunate ones, whose source of income is only labor and whose incomes are very low or nil, as in case of unemployed. But the entire property income should not be eliminated, as it will act as a disincentive to hard work and to save. 2. The institution of private ownership also includes right to inherit. But the income from the inherited property may not be much justified, as the inheritor has done nothing or little to deserve it. Hence, inequalities associated with such unequal asset distribution need be done away substantially, if not completely. 3. Quite a large part of differences in the labor income is due to the differences in the nature of work. Example, sweepers' job, mine workers, management, etc. has also become because of the variety of skills required for different jobs. Now inequalities based on these have to be accepted so as to attract persons with suitable aptitudes or skills for these different occupations. 4. For development to proceed, it is necessary to encourage certain types of skills and discourage others which are no longer needed. For this, higher rewards have to be offered to the former and lower rewards to the latter. Inequalities on this count too are justified. 5. Inequalities also promote savings, because people with higher incomes have higher propensity to save. This argument, however, loses its validity of adequate savings in forthcoming from the government and or the public sector undertakings. So long this is not the case, inequalities of income are helpful for making available resources for investment. Obviously, if people with high income are indulging in wasteful consumption expenditure, such inequalities become undesirable. 6. At the present stage of man's consciousness, when money is perhaps the strongest motive of life, it is not desirable to abolish the practice of rewarding different works or achievements differently, or to impose monetary penalties in case of inefficiency or failures, etc. For this reason, as also for the inequalities that are justified, there cannot be completely equality. The next is intolerable inequalities. Beyond the desirable inequalities, there is absolutely no justification for unequal income. If, however, undesirable inequalities prevail, then these give rise to many evil consequences. In the poor country like India, large many people with little or almost nil incomes at the bottom are unable to meet their bare needs for sheer physical existence. This tells heavily on their health and efficiency, and therefore on production. Many of the few with vastly larger incomes indulge in luxury and often wasteful consumption. At both the ends, society's resources are wasted. In the former case, because of the labor factor does not contribute much, and in the latter case, the resources are misdirected into socially unacceptable channels. Such a situation causes tension among the classes. If these inequalities continue amidst mass poverty, the people in the democratic setup ceases to put up with such a situation. In India, with a very large population living in the life of utter poverty, caused also by inequalities and widespread unemployment, it should not be difficult to see why there is general dissatisfaction among the people. The situation is definitely beyond the limits of desirability. In fact, it is very desirable. Hence, these inequalities need to be reduced substantially. The next is promoting mass goods and welfare. Reduction in undesirable inequalities is essential for a healthy functioning of the democratic society. It is also important for giving the mass orientation to development. If more purchasing power is placed in the hands of the people at the lowest rung of the income, there will be a massive increase in the demand for necessities or wage goods. This will necessitate the scale of production to expand enormously, resulting in the lowering of costs and prices. This will also create opportunities for more employment. This will also provide an expanded base of rapid development of the economy. This is in total contrast to the present situation, wherein the production pattern is tilted in favor of luxury goods. The scale of production is constrained by the small-sized market. The costs and prices are high, and the employment is rising slowly. Reduction in inequalities will therefore be helpful in growth and well-being of the poorer classes. A policy to reduce inequalities through income transfer from the rich to the poor will result in the increase in the social welfare. This is because the welfare loss of the rich will be far less than the welfare gain of the poor. They will thus be the net gain for the society. This argument can, of course, be stretched to advocate a policy to complete income equality. But it is not desirable because this will take away the incentives to more work, skill formation, etc. Now, the next is government measures. As part of the objective of growth with social justice, government has undertaken various measures to curb the evil of inequalities. These measures have encompassed personal distribution as also its other aspects like urban-rural inequalities and states or regional disparities. These measures may be grouped under two broad groups, namely those which are intended to level down the incomes of the few at the top and those which raise the income of the large many at the bottom. Leveling down. As for the first set of measures are concerned, the following are noteworthy. 1. Is the structure of taxation, which has some progressive features. There consists of higher tax rates at higher incomes and larger taxes on luxury items, etc. 2. There are measures that aim at the concentration of wealth in a few hands. In the rural areas, it has taken the form of ceiling on land which an individual can hold. 3. There is then a measure of general nature, namely the existence of the public sector. There are, of course, other reasons too for this policy, but the reduction in inequalities is one of the major ones. Public ownership of some industries and financial institutions with considerable investments have helped in restricting the field of ownership by few in these fields. Leveling up. As for the second set of measures to raise the economic conditions of the have-nots are concerned, the important ones are the following. 1. There are various schemes pertaining to the transfer of resources, assets or incomes to the poor. These are, for example, distribution of surplus land under the policy of ceiling on land, grant of house suits to the poor, subsidies for some items of consumption, subsidized inputs for production such as credit, fertilizers, as also other facilities to certain specific weak section of population like marginal and small farmers, etc. 2. There are special programs of employment designed for specific and weak groups. These are, for example, Swarna Jayanti Gram Swarojgar Yojana, SGSY, Jawahar Gram Samriddhi Yojana, JGSY, etc. and programs made specifically for tribal people, hill people, etc. 3. There is the policy of promoting very small industries called tiny industries and cottage industries aimed at providing employment to the poor workers, artisans, etc. and raising their incomes. 4. There is the general policy of extending public utility services with an emphasis on meeting the needs of the low-income groups. These consist of extension of facilities for health, education, drinking water, etc. 5. The policy of reducing the fast-growing population among the poor is also helpful in as far as it raises the income status of the poor and thereby improves the income distribution.